Welcome to Life on the Illinois Prairie. Your host is Wendy Fleming Dexter, and after 30 years living in small-town Illinois, she has stories to tell. Past cornfields and factories, into the heart of Amish country. There's more here than what meets the eye, far beyond what you think you know. So buckle up and stay tuned. This is Life on the Illinois Prairie.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Life on the Illinois Prairie. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. I want to thank you for joining me today. Today I want to start off, this episode should be published February 20th, and I want to start off, I feel bad I have not mentioned that February is Black History Month, and I had seen that Google was not acknowledging that or putting it on their calendars, and I feel like that's a very important part of the history and future of this country to not have mentioned or not acknowledged in their calendars. And I just want to do that. It's very important. And I think we should always remember and be mindful and honor the Black people in the history of this country and what they're living through in today's world. And we know all want to remember all those who struggle, who are vulnerable, and who are fighting for justice and equality in what I'm ashamed to say in this world, in this year of 2025. I just feel like I need to get that off my chest. And if you have money you'd like to consider, if you'd like to donate to a couple of very worthy causes, I would suggest the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a wonderful organization that fights hate groups, and that is so important to battle that. And then the American Civil Liberties Union, also another organization that does a lot of good for those of us who are just common citizens in this country. So I would also like to read something that I have, for those of you who know that I've been for a lot of last year, digging through all these totes and boxes and memorabilia and things that I've found for my family. I've been decluttering my home, and I'm organizing, and I've been finding all of these things, these tidbits of information that some things I knew existed, some things I had no idea existed. But I came across this, and I want to read it at the beginning of this podcast, and then at the end of the podcast, I'm going to tell you, I would like for you to guess what year that you think this information was written, where this piece was written. And it reads, "These are very unusual times, when half the world is engaged in war, and the other half is greatly disturbed by various groups of people, each trying to find the more abundant life by following the teachings of many of the isms and political quackery. These are offered today as a substitute for the great American ideals of honesty, fair dealing, and the principles of the Golden Rule. It is amid these surroundings that we raise the question, is it not time for us to stop for a brief period and consider where we are going?" So I'd like for you to just think about that for a minute and just think about what year you think that information might have been written. And so the topic that today, this title that I'm calling this podcast, is Mama's Family. Now, for many of you who may remember, several decades ago, there was a sitcom with Carol Burnett and Vicki Lawrence. It's called Mama's Family. A very silly show, but I loved it. It was very funny. But in going through some of these things of my mother's, I found these manila envelopes full of paperwork of my grandmother and her mother. And so to get into the heart of this episode, I know you've heard me speak about all this, but some of my family had thought that it was inappropriate, I'm sure, when I did the Unknown Sister series, to reveal the family history, and probably thought it should have been swept under the rug. Obviously, the people who felt that way were, I'm sorry, fellas, but mostly men who had no idea what I went through during the years when my mother inherited money, then fell in love with my ex-husband, Mike, and turned her back on my dying father. Now, although I've said often that my mother had many redeeming qualities and that she had been brainwashed by Mike, I still do not feel that I may have presented a good representation of my mother and her upbringing. My mother was a great mother. She really was. I mean, she was a stay-at-home mom, as many were in that generation. I was born in 1952. You know, we did come home to milk and cookies. You know, Mom didn't work. She worked like a dog in the house, but she didn't work outside of the house. You know, and she was, our home life was stable. You know, we pretty well knew what was going to happen. We were going to go, we'd go visit family. We'd go for rides on Sunday afternoon. I didn't come, you know, my father didn't drink. My mother didn't run around. They didn't do those kind of things. We did have a very happy family life. But when I look back, looking back through these paperwork, I knew things about my grandmother, I knew my grandma, my mother's mother, Grace Rittenhouse. She was legally blind. I knew she worked for 40 years at Hayes Freight, a trucking company in Mattoon. And I knew that her mother had also been blind. But I didn't know a whole lot beyond that, really, because we didn't talk. Mom talked about them a little bit, but those, you know, other than my grandmother, my great-grandmother was long gone by the time I was born. So I unearthed even more information on my mom's side of the family. And I knew that my great-grandmother, Martha, had been married to a railroader by the name of Kelly. My great-grandmother had two children. That would be my mother's Aunt Bess and Aunt Min. And Mom spoke about them when we were kids. I don't remember every meeting them, but Mom always said that Aunt Min was very odd, and she didn't have a filter. She would say anything that came into her head. And so my grandmother had these two little babies when they were just tiny, little children. He was a railroader, and when they went on these runs, I guess he got another girl, and Mom wrote in quotes, in trouble, and great-grandma divorced him so that he could marry the other woman, which he did not do. And so here was my great-grandmother left with two young children, two babies, at the age of 35, my great-grandmother married Charles Sawyer. He was 67. Again, she was 35. He was 67. And it was rumored to be a marriage of convenience, and it must have been very convenient for Mr. Sawyer, because my great-grandmother became pregnant with my grandmother, Grace Maud Adele Sawyer. 6 weeks later, Mr. Sawyer died, leaving my great-grandmother with three small children. And so one of those children grew up with my grandmother. My grandmother and my great-grandmother, my grandmother and my mother were all born and raised in 3120 Marion in Mattoon. And one of the more interesting things that I came across, some of the things I came across, listen to this. Anybody that pays taxes will find this absolutely mind-boggling. I came upon a property tax paper from receipt from June 9th, 1899. And my great-grandmother, Martha Sawyer, paid $3.95. I don't know if that was, it doesn't say if it's one installment, two installments, but that's what was paid in that date. And then there was a later one. By this time in 1940, my grandma Rittenhouse was living in that same place, and her tax bill, I think this must have been her first installment of 1939 real estate tax, was $6.37. Isn't that crazy? And then in 1948, Grandma paid $13.72 for her taxes. Isn't that crazy? I came upon those papers, and another one of the papers that I had found was when my great-grandma Sawyer had signed over ownership to the house. And one of the more, I ran across something that was so perplexing to me. And I will never know the answer to this, why I found this paper and what it actually means. But this paper, this poem, my grandmother was, she wrote poetry, she wrote poems, she rhymed. But this was written, ironically, on February 13th, 1917. Today is February 13th, 2025. And this is the poem that my grandmother wrote to a man I've never heard of in my entire life until I found this paper. It's written to a Mr. Speck Williams, 619 Central Avenue, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And it says, "Dearest Speck, your letter reached me yesterday, and it makes me feel quite young and gay. My sad heart throbs with holy joy whene'er I hear from my little boy. What though the sky be dark and drear, and the moan of the wind through the trees I hear, if I read your letter and you but say, 'I love you, 'tis a perfect day.' My soul was filled with sad despair. My grief, I thought, I could not bear. It seemed my heart must burst with pain. I prayed for death, but I prayed in vain. I thought I ne'er could be Speck's bride, and to a monster I was tied. So to a drugstore swift I hied, to sink my griefs in suicide. And then my grief was turned to joy. 'Twas a letter from my little boy. The poison 'gainst the wall I hurl, for Speck still loves his little girl. You ask me if I love you true. I need not answer that I do. For though I'm wedded to another, my love's for you and for no other. What joy 'twould be if I were only free from the bonds of matrimony, which press like a yoke upon my neck, when I think of my love for you, dear Speck. I married a man I've learned to hate, but 'twas all decided by the hand of fate. Away with sorrow, I think how sweet our joy will be when first we meet. Though trouble now has clutched me tight, still through the gloom I see a light, and bravely forward I press on, till darkest just before the dawn. Alas, time flies regretfully. I'll have to bid farewell to thee. But deeply hidden in my heart is the thought someday we'll never part. And then no sorrow will mar the joy of mother and me and my little boy. For all we know, 'tis true when they say, true love will always find a way. So, Speck, don't forget me whatever you do. I'll always be patient waiting for you. I'm sending a long-distance kiss and embrace. Be sure to write soon to your little girl, Grace." Wow. That is so confusing to me on so many levels. I found this. This was on yellowed paper, obviously written in 1917. But it's so confusing, and I'll explain to you why, because it says it was written February 17, 1917. She married my grandfather on December 25th, 1917. I also found their marriage license among these papers. But she says in here that, you know, I realize she may be taking some poetic license, but she said she's married to a man she hates. And that's confusing for one thing. And then when she's talking about committing suicide, wow. I mean, these are things I never dreamed I would be reading about my grandmother. It's so bizarre. And I'm so glad. I guess there's a reason that these things sat in totes for all these years for me to find now. And I went through things to find paperwork for my Unknown Sister series, but And now I've found letters and documents. I've found wedding, marriage licenses, death certificates. I found a marriage bond certificate, and I didn't even know what that was. Apparently, that's when it was from Kentucky, and apparently that's when you promise that you're going to marry somebody, but it's not a legally binding document. You say you're going to marry them, and I'll give you $100, but they don't give them $100. So I found all these amazing, amazing documents. But I will never know the answer to who this man was and why my grandmother was so in love with him. And the thing about my grandparents that is already a little bit confusing is that they divorced and married a second time. So I'll go back here. Let me backtrack a little bit to my grandma Sawyer, my great-grandma Sawyer. She took in laundry and cleaned houses to feed her little family that she had the three children after her second husband died and left her after the baby was 6 weeks old, my grandmother. And she was a tiny, wiry little woman who lost a sight in one eye from chopping wood. And Mom said she wore a glass eye. She remembered taking it out and putting it in a glass by her bedside table. And then as she aged, she lost the sight in her other eye and could just barely pick her way through the house by following a path and voices. I mean, she lived in that house all of her life. And my grandma Rittenhouse, my mother's mother, she worked for 40 years at Hayes Freight. And according to what my mother had written, grandma was probably happiest being at work, leaving the raising of my mother to my great-grandmother, Sawyer. Mom had really little supervision of reading her papers that she had left as a child. She didn't run the street. She was not promiscuous. She did not run wild. She said grandma more than once was afraid that mom would be, in quote, lying in the weeds with some boy. But even though when grandma was home, she ruled with an iron fist, and more than once did mom say that she would get switched by grandma. Ironically, mom said that was the most attention she got from her mother was when she was switched, because there was really no physical affection between my grandmother and my mother. Demonstrative. Grandma was not demonstrative to my mother. In fact, when I was a little kid, I remember my mother calling my grandmother a cold fish. And mom wrote in her, had some papers she'd written a little bit about her history. And she said one night she leaned in to kiss my grandma Rittenhouse goodnight. And she told her that that was no longer necessary and that there was not any physical closeness between them, no hugging, and none of that nonsense. My grandma was a working woman, and I guess that's what she preferred to do. My grandfather, on the other hand, Grandpa Rittenhouse, whom I never met because he died before I was born, he was another story. You know, mom got an allowance, but if she ever needed any extra money, mom mowed the yard and took care of the coal and the kindling to keep the furnace going. But she could always go to her dad if she needed extra money. But he was the jack of all trades and never had any steady employment. But mom always knew she came up short from her allowance that she could always bum some money from her dad. And a lot of what she spent her money on, she would walk from where she lived grew up at 3120 Marion to her grandma Rittenhouse, lived over at 820 DeWitt. That's several blocks. And she would walk over to see her other grandmother. And she would often stop at the ice cream store and buy sheet music because she used to play the piano when she was a little girl. And then often she would go with her girlfriend Eileen, and they'd go to the movies, always go to the movies. But I guess my grandfather, mom said, he was very generous to others, especially one of their housekeepers. Since grandma worked and great-grandma Rittenhouse, or grandma Sawyer, great-grandma Sawyer was blind, they had housekeepers. And one of mom's favorites was a lady named Leota. And it turns out that she was also one of Grandpa Rittenhouse's favorites, too, because in short order, Grandma Rittenhouse divorced Grandpa, and he was left high and dry when Leota turned her back on him, too. So when he came back, Grandpa Rittenhouse came back. I don't know how long that relationship lasted, but I do know that when he came back, that he almost begged my grandma to remarry, and he did. And my mother stood up with them, and she was 13 years old. So they married a second time. They married the first time, Christmas Day, in Terre Haute, in 1917, and which is going back to that poem to Speck. She said she was married to a man that she hated. In February 13th of 1917. So the dates don't add up. I'll never know why, I don't suppose. But the second time they remarried in Charleston. And my grandmother was very specific when she married my grandfather that there would be no funny business, that there wouldn't be any slip-ups. She made him sleep in a separate room for 6 months after they got married. So, and my mother was born 2.5 years after they got married. She was born in 1920. They were married in 1917. So she was very specific that there would be no accidents, and there were not. And so, you know, these women have had, my great-grandmother had to be very self-sufficient because she was a mother of three and alone after losing two husbands. My grandmother was the main breadwinner because she was obviously the stronger of the two of that couple. She did not, he had many jobs, and Grandma had one job and kept it for all of her life. She was a bookkeeper, not a bookkeeper. She went around and collected bills because Mom said sometimes on Saturday she would ride around with her to collect. I don't know if it was collecting bills from people that hadn't, you know, that owed money to the trucking company because of, they were behind in their bills, or if it's just regular payments. I really didn't understand that part, but here was my mom. Mom was an only child, and she came. Her mother was a very strong woman, and a strong-willed and a hard worker. And then her mother before her had been a very strong woman. And then my mother was raised as a pretty independent person. It's pretty crazy to me. She was very independent. She didn't have to answer to anybody. She answered to her grandmother, who was legally blind, and Mom pretty well did what she wanted because her mother worked and her dad, while he wasn't home, he must have been chasing housekeepers because she didn't have anybody that was really keeping track of Mom. So, when you think about Mom coming from that background of mainly women, you know, women dominating the households, there wasn't a strong male model in the home. And then my mom marries a man who, number one, Mom grew up in town, and my dad grew up in the country. Dad had, I think, a family of 8 brothers and sisters, and his father had died when he was 13, so... You know, he had a strong woman in his life too, so it's very crazy. And then here I come along, and I'm the only girl among 6 boys, and tucked right in the middle, right at the last before my younger brother Sam was born. And but Mom never indicated that great grandma Sawyer was anything but happy. I mean, she seemed to be a happy person for as much hardship as she had to deal with in her life, and just so many crazy things that I unearthed, and this is just some of it. It may just seem pretty random, but I found note cards. Mom had a cousin. I mentioned her, her aunt Bess, and Bess had two daughters. One of her daughters was named Ellen, and the other one was named Linda. And so I came across this card, and I find this so odd. It says, "Dear Grace, I had a nice Christmas. Charlie's depression is not over Mom's death, but over the money he's not going to get. Hope you had a nice Christmas. Right. Love, Ellen Louise." And isn't that, if anybody who's followed The Unknown Sister, that's so ironic, because this is talking about mother's cousins being depressed, not because his mother died, but because he may not inherit some money. So I guess it goes back a ways in the family, this crazy obsession with money. So I found another thing that just floored me, was that my grandmother, my Grandma Rittenhouse, like I said, lived at 3120 Marion, and there came a time in the late 60s where she was no longer able to live alone. She was widowed. She was legally blind. Her health was deteriorating, and my mother could not take her in. She was the only child, and Mom could not take Grandma in as a blind person living in our home. We had kids, young kids. It was just too chaotic. It would have never worked. And like Mom said, they were never close. And so Mom had to put her mother in a nursing home. And even though they weren't close, when your own mother says, you know, I hate you, never come back. I never want to see you again as long as I live. That's kind of hard to hear. And that's what Mom heard from her mother when she did finally have to put her in a nursing home. But this is the paper that I found that totally just blows my mind, because it's an application. I don't even know if my mother knew about this. This was in a bunch of my mom's, my grandma's paperwork. It was in a manila envelope. And it's an application for admission as a resident to the Mary Bryant Home for Blind Men and Women of Illinois. I'd never heard of it. I knew my grandma didn't want to leave her home. She did not want to go in a nursing home. So on one hand, I'm totally blown away by this fact that she was applying to this facility for the blind. But at the same time, I have to remind myself that in reading her letters from when she was a resident in a couple of nursing homes, a couple in Charleston, Illinois, and then one in Mattoon, especially the ones in Charleston, when she was in these nursing homes, it was about the time that Illinois closed a lot of their mental health facilities, and a lot of people were put out in general population that really did not belong there. And if they didn't have a home to go to, many of them went to a nursing home. And so people like my grandmother, who was old and blind and vulnerable, and she told in her letters of having people standing over her or having a knife or threatening her, you know. So when I think about that, then this kind of makes sense, but I had no idea that she would have applied to this place to go and live. And it's legal size paper. It's like 4 pages of this application. And it's all filled out in red pen. It's just as clear and fresh as if it was written yesterday. But the thing is, Grandma Rittenhouse died. She had to have applied to this place in 1968, 68, 69, because she was in a nursing home. She died in Mattoon in a nursing home in 1970. But the thing is, I didn't know this place existed. And I Googled it and I looked up, and it's still in existence in 2025 in Springfield, Illinois, and it's on Facebook. And I found it's a wonderful facility and a very nice nice place, very well respected. And so that was just these things that I'm finding. I feel bad when people aren't, number one, I feel bad when people aren't interested in their backgrounds or their roots, and they don't have access to all these things, number one, because I have another whole month's worth of things to read on my dad's side, letters that were written to my grandmother from her family. But I knew a little more about them, I thought, but I'm finding out more about my mother. She just didn't talk in great deal about her family that much. So I did find another poem that she had written. Grandma just was very, I think it just came naturally to me and I, or to her, and I think I kind of inherited a little bit of her rhyming skill. I would never say poet, but she definitely was a poet, I think. So this is another one of her many poems that I found, and this one said, "Brethren and sistern of the tribe of Hayes, pushers of pencils, drivers of drays, to all in this gang that is now gathered here, a most Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. But first, may I say to this gay congregation, before we start in on this big celebration, there is something that I think I'd like to suggest, and that is, let's welcome our most honored guest, the man who has given his time and his wealth, the man who has even endangered his health, to build up a business for you and for me. Our boss, we welcome you, Mr. OZ. We want you to know that we're glad you are able, after all, being ill, to sit at our table. We hope that quite soon you'll be feeling so spry that a leap o'er the table you'll be wanting to try. So now, all together, folks, join in with me. Three rousing cheers for our boss, Carl OZ. And Carl OZ was the president of the company where Grandma Rittenhouse worked, Hayes Freight. And for those of you who remember back to the beginning of the podcast when I read the dedication, the year, if anybody, I'm curious, if you're listening to this, please send me the information. Tell me what years you guessed, because I will read it again, and then I will read the last of it. And these words were written by Carl OZ in 1939. He said, "These are very unusual times when half the world is engaged in war and the other half is greatly disturbed of it by various groups of people, each trying to find the more abundant life by following the teaching of many of the isms and political quackery. These are offered today as a substitute for the great American ideals of honesty, fair dealing, and the principles of the Golden Rule. It is amid these surroundings that we raise the question, is it not time for us to stop for a brief period and consider where we are going?" And he said, skipping down another line or two, he said, "Thus it is upon these great principles of freedom and equality for all that this great America of ours has come through the years, exemplifying a theory of life and living that has successfully stood the test of time. Should we not, all of us, do everything in our power to encourage and preserve this great heritage of ours, that we may enjoy the rights and privileges given us under the Constitution of the United States, and to reconsecrate ourselves to make America for Americans?" I guess either side could lay claim to that, couldn't they? In these times that we're in right now, these topsy-turvy, crazy, perilous times that we're in, you know, if you've listened before, you know, I've promised I'm not going to let myself be consumed by fear. I'm not drowning my fears with alcohol. I'm not hiding behind any other substances to get me through. I'm meditating, and I'm trying to be positive and make myself a better person and hope that I can help others try to do the same. I'm so far from being a good person. I'm so far astray sometimes, and I have so many bad habits to relearn. But the thing is, I'm trying. And I don't want to live in fear every day of my life. I don't want to bury my head in the sand completely. I know what's going on. I don't like it. But even my cardiologist, when I told him about it and told him that, you know, that I was trying to do meditation, he said, "I don't think you can do anything better." He said, "We our hands are tied to a certain extent. You know, there are things we can do when those things come along, be it voting, working for your party, and doing the things that we can do, do it. If you want to support a wonderful cause, anti-hate groups, like I said, Southern Poverty Law Center is a great place to go. Southern Poverty Law Center and American Civil Liberties Union. And that's just all I have to say on that. And I'm going to close this should be published. This episode will be on February 20th. And God willing, and everything works out great, I should be on the I'll be on my way to the operating table because I'm getting my hip replaced. Hip, hip, goodbye. I'm saying hip, hip, goodbye. I have a bad right hip and I want to get rid of it. And so I'm having a wonderful surgeon, Dr. Mandela, and Sarah Bush Lincoln do it. And that's what I'm going to be doing on February 20th if we don't get snow and ice and I get snowed in. So I want to thank you for listening to this, and I hope that you've learned a little bit more about my mama's family and the women in the family. There's a reason that I think that the stubbornness is there. I wasn't just born this way, Stacy. It's hard for people to understand sometimes, but I do come from a long line of women that were, kind of had to stand up for themselves. And when you have five brothers, you have to stand up even more and speak a little louder. And sometimes in this day and age, that's what we got to do. But speak your truth. And if you like this podcast, please go to my Life on the Illinois Prairie Facebook page and leave a comment. And please tell your friends and family and share this with your friends and family. And above all, please, please be kind. Thanks for listening to Life on the Illinois Prairie, the undercurrents of our American life. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to Life on the Illinois Prairie wherever you get your podcast. Stay tuned for more stories, interviews, and updates. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. Until next time.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.